So, good morning, everyone, or someone at least. I don't count too many heads. Good morning. This is the second session of the DNS Working Group at Drive 58. My name is still Peter Koch, absent and irreparative. I'll try to guide you to this morning's session as well. Apologize for that in advance. Some administrative to start with. For those of you probably not present here yesterday, the DNS Working Group has a homepage, which is listed here. We do have a mailing list. I won't repeat this completely. You see two ways to access the mailing list and get on there. Again, today there will be online support for remote participation done by Wolfgang on the Java channel. Do we have remote participation today as well? Okay. Okay. So, okay. So anyway, good morning there in Java land as well. For the benefit of the minute taker, and also for the benefit of the people in the room and remote participants, if you would like to make any comments, which you're encouraged to after the presentations, please go to the microphones in the aisles, state your name and your affiliation if you so desire. Which brings us to another overview of today's agenda. We will start with another report from the RIPE-NCC, given by Anand, who I just saw speaking into the room there, on the reverse tree-laying delegation reports and the experiences RIPE-NCC can report right now and here. After that, Patrick will give us an overview of the OpenDNSSEC software, followed by another presentation by Matthijs Micking about the AutoTrust software. João will present some results from a survey on pre-delegation checks done by various TOD registries, or registries, I should say. Johan Meeren will present his thoughts and considerations regarding DNS root zone scaling. We will have the opportunity to do some follow-up discussion for the two plenary presentations that touched the DNS, the one by Olafur regarding Trust Anchor repositories, and the other one by Erik Osterweil regarding the path MTU issues with eDNS0/DNSSEC. We have one follow-up item from yesterday that was action item 58.1, and if we are lucky or unlucky, or if you see that, we will have additional action items today. We'll summarize them at the end, and then we might have another 30 seconds or so for any other business. Any questions or suggestions regarding the agenda? Okay, anyone awake? Anybody? Hey, okay. Wow, such a live audience. Okay, then I'd like to ask Anand to come to the stage and present about these reverse stuff, and we'll have some discussion afterward, I guess. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Armin Butterdorf, DNS Services Manager at the RIPE-NCC, and I'm going to give you a brief report about the DNS checks that we've been running for a while now. First, a little bit of history. We as in the RIPE-NCC received a request from the DNS Working Group and our community to do checks in the reverse tree, and this was way back in 2006. So in January 2007, the RIPE-NCC produced a document, RIPE 400, and this document laid out, I can see
obviously Brett's wife, and because he was the author, Brett's in the room as well. This document laid out a plan for what we would do and how we would do it. And in this document, there is a definition of leanness. There are various ways of looking at it, but the right answer is to define a specific way of measuring leanness. And a high-level description of the process which we would use to do these leanness measurements. In the latter half of 2007, we began a process. We started writing software to actually do these measurements. So some details about the actual measurements. They're done from a server located in the RIPE-NCC network. What happens is that at the beginning of the month, on the first day of the month, the software takes a snapshot of all the reverse delegations that it can see. After that, it goes away and resolves every name server into its IPv4 and IPv6 addresses. Repeated until it can either find an answer or get back an NX domain. And after that, every IP address that the software has discovered is queried. It sends a query for an SOA record, and it makes several attempts to find an answer. The query is done over UDP, and is non-recursive. So what are the responses that we expect? First of all, we check to see if the server responds at all. In many cases, they don't. We also check to see that the response comes from the same IP address that we sent the query to. The response code has to be no error. The response must have the authoritative bit set, and that the answer contains the same zone that we sent in the query. And that only one SOA record is returned, we sometimes see more than one SOA record coming back. So a lack of a response or non-compliance with any of these conditions is regarded as an error condition, and we flag this as a lame delegation. So some results from the measurements that we've been doing so far. We found that before we started taking any action, there was about 6% of lane delegations in all the reverse zones. This graph is interesting. You see some strange peaks there. We found that there was an IPv6 related bug in our software, and that was fixed in September 2008. And so you see a drop in the black line that runs to the graph. The black line is a measure in a percentage of the amount of lameness. So after fixing this bug, we found that things were stable and it was about 6%. There's also a little peak in February 2009. We had some measurement problems. We had some human problems. And that was the cause of this little peak. So that's anomalous. You can see that if you look at the end for April 2009, this is like dropping lameness. And that's actually a result of the alerts that we've been sending out. So after we began with the measurements, our plan was to move on to email alerts. And that's phase two. So what our software does is build a database of all the email contacts, and it does that by first looking in the rname field of the SOA record. It also looks in the right database. It looks at the main objects, and it looks at the notify and maintain by attributes, and it picks out email addresses from there. At the end of every measurement cycle, we generate email alerts to all those email addresses that are associated with main delegations. We send out emails with unique envelope senders so that we can also capture bounces quite easily and get an idea of how many requests are failing. So we began with a test run in September 2008. We sent email alerts to a small number of people. We got some feedback from that, and we fixed a couple of little problems there. And we began full-scale alerts in February of 2009. In February, we sent out 6,695 messages, just over 1,200 of them bounced back. In March, we sent out 4,173, so considerably fewer messages, 937 of them bounced. And there was an observable effect in the lameness. It went down to just about 5%. So our email alerts have had an effect on users. We got mixed responses, which is not completely surprising. Some people silently went and fixed their setups and their configurations, and lameness went away. A few people actually wrote back and said, thank you, we didn't realize that things were broken and we fixed them. Some people weren't quite sure why they'd received these alerts, even though they weren't actually operating in zones. And a few people were quite annoyed. So they wrote back to us or raised discussions on the DNS working group mailing list and made their opinions quite clear. So we have become aware of a number of issues in this measurement. At the moment, there's no record of the date and time of the probes, so we have no way of letting any user know when a particular probe has failed. A fixed timeout of 3 seconds is used for all the other queries for SOA records. We think that they should probably be flexible, should probably be increased for failed queries. The measurements are all done from a single server at the right entity, so we have no other server out there on the internet doing measurements, so we don't have a second opinion. And problems within the right entity network may skew the results. And we've been improving our documentation, and we think that we can improve it further still and give even more details about the probes, the measurements we're doing, so that people have a good idea of what's going on. Our problems and issues with the email alerts. At the moment, the email address lookup algorithm uses the main game by and the updates attributes in the domain objects, and that's not quite ideal. We don't have an opt-out facility yet. I think some people might like that. And we think that the alert frequency is probably a bit too high. You know, we send out alerts every month, and some people have said it's starting to look spammy. So perhaps once every 3 months might be more appropriate, but we haven't decided on that yet. And when we send out alerts and people fix their setups, they don't have a tool that they can use at the right MCC to check whether their delegation is still okay or broken. So what do we want to do in the future? We think that the service is quite useful to many people, despite the teething problems we've had, and we would very much like to continue running this. We've received several ideas and suggestions, and we'd like to incorporate them into our code and into our procedures. And we've recently published a technical document on our website describing more details about actual probes that we do and how they run, and we think we can improve upon that even further. At the moment, the DNS department handles all the tickets, related tickets that come in, but we think we can hand this over to our customer services department and the agency to deal with their sort of FAQ or frequently asked Actually, a very good suggestion, and somebody else has mentioned it. I think Peter mentioned it in an email, and we're actually looking at doing something along those lines.
Stefan, that's my from I think. You mentioned that you developed the software specifically to for this program. I'm going to give you another one you can find on the website. Why didn't you use one of the existing DNS delegation testing software like DNS check by the Swedish registry or don't check? Because it would have it's always better to reuse and wait than save on scratch. You have already two very good free software DNS delegation testing tools.
Yeah, that's true. I think when the design team looked at this way back in 2007, they realized that none of the existing tools were quite doing what we wanted to do. And so we decided to develop our own software.
We have to be more specific on what was missing, because I'm interested for the future development if something is missing.
Yes, I realize that you're probably interested from the view of DNS Witness, which we're also aware of. We had the requirement to be able to look up in the right database for email contacts. That's one of the things that none of the existing tools would do, for example. And that's one of the reasons we actually went and wrote this. About the queries that it does, there's nothing particularly special. It's a regular query. So that wasn't really the reason. It wasn't being so much DNS related as who is related. I don't know if that answers the question.
For the sake of time, could we take detailed discussion either to the list or offline? Thank you. I'm happy to take detailed discussion to the list, but when I did put detailed discussion on the list, I was told to wait to the right meeting and we've discussed it here. So, I was referring to the detailed discussion of deficiencies in other testing software. Okay. So, I'm going to give some full disclosure before I make a few comments, which is that I think that we spend a lot more time in the DNS community doing delegation checking than is appropriate. I think, the beautiful thing about DNS is that once it's delegated, the user who has the delegation is the one who gets the benefit, so they have the responsibility and the ability to make their service as good as they want. So I think we should be careful in not overdoing it, and I think, quite frankly, that this delegation, with all these emails that we're sending, there's a lot of work that's being used here, both in right NCC resources and even way more in these tens of thousands of emails that people are receiving that they have to figure out what to do with, or even just figure out if they can ignore it or not. So I did raise the question on the list is whether or not we should consider continuing this activity. And before you respond to that, I'll talk about some of the things that we can do before we make that decision. And one is, I think if we have better metrics, we can have a much better sense of how much this is helping. And we saw some metrics which I think are actually pretty weak. We looked at the number of domains, but I don't know if that actually counted. If I have a domain and I've got five servers and one of them is lame, or maybe my Q6 is lame, that means something different than if I have a server and all of them are lame, for instance. So I think we need a little more detail on what exactly this lameness is measuring. And even further, I just like
skins.
That was a nice day.
What is this with tall people?
Nice time track, thank you. The DNS is designed to be accommodating with bit rot. There is not a strict coherency requirement in the DNS. It's loosely coherent. And if you turn, so having things lame for a while, or temporarily, or even for a long time, really impacts the child who is going lame or has gone lame, and the parent sort of gets a little, you know, irritated about it. But if you spend lots of time calling all of your children and knocking on their doors and letting them know that you think that something's wrong, they may turn and say, "Yeah, we know something's wrong. Go away. None of your business. Your only, you know, your option at that point is to remove the delegation." People get the chance or the choice, because of the hierarchical nature of the DNS, to run their delegations the way they want to. Conversely, if you are so, I use this word, fascist, about checking, you know, chasing down what you think of as lame delegations, would you feel equally comfortable if all of the right NCC members and everybody else who happens to touch something in the inner space start sending you complaints about the fact that the right NCC is doing something wrong? It's a lot of email, right? So I don't think that you really need, that we really need to be this sterile in trying to keep the DNS tightly coherent.
Why not? I mean, if we just leave things as they are, they will, you know, there will be no improvement. This way, at least,
how do you define improvement?
Improvement as in, you know, if there is breakage and people aren't aware of it, they can, you know, fix it. There are some people who choose to ignore us and don't care, which is fine. You know, we're not the police. We're not going to go and remove the delegations. But there are people who do benefit from these checks, who, you know, thank us and say, yes, this was a useful thing to do, and
I simply give a counter example that not everybody is appreciative of the constant harassment.
Yes, and that's why you mentioned an opt-out facility, so that some people can choose to perhaps not receive messages from us.
I'd like to close the queue off the wall.
Yeah, Professor Stuhl, I'll randomize again. I would say that from my experience, most customers are happy to get the information about the problems they have with MDNS. And secondly, I read the report on the DSSR that was mentioned yesterday, and there it was said that many people, when
to love.
Okay, thank you. So now, I am in the uncomfortable situation to try to make a summary here. First of all, I think the working group at one point in time actually approved the proposal by the Ripen CC, or actually tasked the Ripen CC to go ahead with this. And later saying, okay, this is all rubbish, that's a bit tough. I mean, the working group can change their mind, obviously.
Hang on.
So that's fine.
Some results where doing these things a couple of months into the protocol analysis as well.
idea is that what Shane is trying to say, and I need to understand some of this correctly, of course there are errors in there, and errors will be fixed. But the question is, what impact do these errors actually have? Because if there is zones, there are query, the error is there, but it doesn't have any impact. Is that
correct? That's correct.
Or we can very rarely query for so on. Okay, okay. So, so the question is, for Alec and his group, what could they do right now, right? So, continue and improve the performance and quality of these tickets and stuff. Or suspend any further sending of tickets until some research paper has been published on all the background license. But we need to get this closed somehow.
It's a collaboration between several organizations. It's a nominate element labs, Ray, Sarput, and Tom Nickinson's who's helping out. It's a nice to be everybody knows it's possible to have a good summary for the sake. So that's what the Google gives. It's a very good signer. It does nothing else but signs some parts. Takes an unsigned zone and signs it and sends out an unsigned zone. Supposed to be without any strange stuff going in brought this major summit. It's a device that stores keys in hardware, at least the master key. It has different levels of hardware security. The highest levels, which is the American security standard, doesn't allow even the temperature in the room to change too much. If it does, then the keys are destroyed. So it depends on the security level you want. You can use major sub. The highest performing devices we have tested is generates 14,000 signatures per second. So that's fast enough to at least sign ourselves, I guess. And well, not that good, but HSMs a number of years ago when we wanted to sign as its own, all the HSMs were very expensive. So today we use smart card as an HSM, which is a very slow device. So we want to connect to other devices as well. So, as an alternative to our device, we developed our own software HSM, which is a software implementation of the same thing. It also has the PKCS 11 support. It uses SQLite to store all the keys on file on the local machine. So you can use that if you want to do development with OpenNSSEC or test sign in overall really. That's your regular songs at home or something. If you're not recording the security level of the relation scan. So the CASP is interlocking some things. This state of keys, it's automatically generates keys if the policy says it's if the policy says that the sum should be signed. So it automatically generates keys for itself. And then it publishes the keys in the software. It uses the keys for signing and also automatically retires all the keys and then removes them. So it runs on the lifetime of the keys in the policy on how fast this process is. There are a number of other metadata that is maintained by the CASP. It's the, all the timing of the keys field when things happen, so that it knows how to remove the keys. It keeps track on each HSM the keys are stored in, so it can give that information to the signer. The unique locator ID is used for that, so the signer can fetch the keys per second. Basically, an ideal command to implement for the CASP is just the command remove key. There is basically no other use for a command to be sent to the CASP. The remove key is basically the remove key or the command emergency key or the remove into one. Because what happens then is that a new key will be generated because the CASP says it still should be signed. We don't have currently that command line interface that will be declared for the CASP, so we don't know actually right now how it should be maintained. And then the signer engine, which is developed by Analog Labs, it does everything with the RSS sorting and prints called SIC or LSIC 3 chains. It also has the R6 that keeps the R6 up to date. That's the basic function of the signer. So it's the overall architecture. The orange blobs is the configuration files. And then you have the unsigned titles fed to the signer. And you have the CASP information, CASP database, using the database system, which is all stuff that the communication which send copies for the signer. So that's the overall view of the architecture. It's supposed to be very this topography and this system. Today is basically like this. You have to have an HSM, so if you want HSM programming, you have to configure the HSM. To configure this of HSM, you have to initialize the token and add that token to the sub-HSM HSM configuration file. And then you add the sub-HSM library in the list of repositories, which is the list of HSMs used in the general context node file, which is the overall OpenDNS configuration. And then you also say how enforcement should be running and how whether the server should look for stuff. And then the task configuration, which is a long list of policies. This is a short example of the default policy, which can be used for all SOAS if you want. And where you have the read sign and refreshing tools for how long signatures should be running, maybe the length of the keys and all information like that. So this is all going to be enforced by CASP. If it fails, it should be over and stop working. What we currently have is a list of zones where you actually say where the outside zones are, where the signed zone files should be output. And the assigned configuration for that you can. The assigned configuration is the configuration file which you cast outputs. So the signed node to read it. And this is the signed configuration, which assigned uses to sign the sign, which contains the location of all the keys. So the purpose of this is you want to roll over an HSM. You can have keys located in another HSM as well. So this is contains all the information that the signer needs to store. So this sign is the software. We have lots of things left to do. We wanted to have an album actually ready this week, but we couldn't postpone right, so we have to postpone the album version a little bit. So we have to integrate all these components and them working together. Okay, all the individual components are working okay by now, but they haven't been integrated. And then we have to have an install guide that user guide to actually have users try this out. We're currently doing peer reviewing within the project, so we repeat each other's components and find out if there's anything wrong in them. Since it's a very modularized project, we want to make OpenDNS a totally integrated thing. That's how much of the system. We have to do more system testing, we have to test the performance of the complete system to see if it can sign a lot of zones or big zones. And we have to do that for a very long time because .sc, .uk as well, we want to use OpenDNS this year to sign both those .uk, so we have to do a lot of testing during the summer. So this is might be to be promised that we won't have a version 1.0 for the IHF and stuff. So everything is uploaded on the website of OpenDNS.sc or .org or .com or anything. We have all the meeting agendas and everything in there. So if you want to look at the source, you can look at it right now if you want to. So thank you. Do you have any questions for me?
Is there anything that you allow for dynamic updates on
some will be online, but if you do dynamic updates, then it will have to be online.
Other questions? I have a question for you regarding this project. So this is kind of a prototype thing for how to run DNSSEC in a registry setting. Is there any opportunity for, say, tailoring this to other registry needs, or what is the idea behind that?
We would really like to have this is designed for anyone who wants to use DNSSEC to be as easy as possible to use it. We will also, it is a DSP license as well, so anyone can integrate it into their own products. If, say, for example, the hyperwellers want to use it for signing their stuff, that's completely fine. It's designed for that as well.
Thank you. I'll touch one of the partners in this project. The ultimate roadmap is to have the ultimate DNSSEC signing tool. That is to say, a piece of software that you can implement on a little device that becomes your black box to sign DNSSEC with a nice key, which you can configure with a few lines of with a few clicks. Policies by which you want to have your zone signed, and then you have this box, and you either put it in your zone generation process, or you put it behind your master server, so then another can take basically bump in the wire, as we call it. That's the ultimate goal. What is presented here is a first step, basically to make sure that the policy engine works. An important component of the system is that it can work with various types of hardware signer engines and a software emulation of that, so that people can provision their own security needs. The intention is really to make a tool that makes DNSSEC deployment trivial. So that's the ultimate goal.
Okay, thank you. Stay to Mike, maybe I have a follow-up question for both of you then. It might be a bit premature to ask this right now, but for anybody considering using this for their production service, what about project support and stuff? Are there any ideas available there? Or maybe a pointer to some document is fine.
I missed the seminal word in this question. Project support, you meant?
Yes, project support. So as a commercial entity, trying to rely on this, who has sent the contract proposal to
him? I know not much is intending, but this is really something that we within the project team needs to finalize. But we're willing to take the software support on our hands. 24/7 is a different question, I guess. But the way we go forward is first walk and then run.
Oh, sure.
The question is a bit premature.
Thanks, Nicholas.
All right. Ask again from Minimize. We testing OpenDNSSEC to be integrated with our DNS management tools, and then there will be also support for this commercial support. But it's not decided if it will work with our current tool. Testing that. No.
Just to expand on that, there is a conscious choice for BSD license so that commercial entities can pick it up and run with it.
Okay, thanks very much. I don't see anybody else at the mic, so thank you very much, Patrick, for the presentation, and thanks. For the additional info, I guess what nice is next to make a presentation.
something that's already out there, but I'm not going to compare them with that. Antitrust follows the guidelines that are described in the RFC 511. Follows their requirements, follows their transition table that's described in there. It is a result of independent trust anchor maintainer. Variation dynamic next to unbound, dynamic next to bind, any result that is deemed set capable. It is highly configurable. It started out as a basic aiding tool, but since I got more questions about it, I've added some useful options on this. And it's making use of the LVMS library and the unbound library. Those are DNS functionalities that I can separate from the algorithm so that we can focus on the corner cases of the algorithm. As I said, it's an aiming tool first project that I have, but I got more questions about it, so I've added some options that I think are useful for real-time situations. For example, you can signal the result for the different anchors are updated. You reverse or to revoke bit not set, there's an option for that. I've added that because hard to see revoke bit setting kilometers at the moment. It's accurate for refresh timers. First of all, it was intended to run from the cron job at fixed timers, but you run the risk of missing a kilometer if you set the rate of the cron job to low. So I've made it demutable, so you can run it as a daemon, and then it follows the exact timers described in the RFC. Version 0.3.1 coming up, that's perfectly perfect, and this is how it fits in your world, maybe. If you have a machine where Zulfur is running, where the trust and the files are maintained, you can put off just up there. On startup, it queries for all the DNS key or sets where which has that trust anchor for. Once it sees a need to update the trust anchor file, it does so and signals the resolver that it should reload again. There's a small issue, it's not the trust anchor feature, so you still have the pain of initially setting up your configured trust anchors, but hey, there are public repositories for that now. There's no trust foundation. It's a bit of a detailed subject, so if you want to have information about that, I'll be in the hallway. One issue with the algorithm for the mark. So, was I? Did any people hear me when I was talking here? Okay. The algorithm doesn't allow for holidays. That means you can put the Octopus offline for 3 months plus, and then put it up back again and just assume that everything resolves just fine, because in the period you might have missed for a few over. And there's a minus to do list, but for that, I guess the tool is ready, and if you're interested in automatic updater for the trust anchors that is resolved independent, please check it out at our website and please try it. And if you have questions or see strange behavior, give it back to us at our setup page or mailing list, and I will be grateful to accept your feedback. Thank you.
Thanks very much for those questions.
So I'll take a bit this short and go straight to the questions I have rather than the report on the survey, because the one thing you get clearly back from looking at the different LPs do for aggregation checks is that there is no uniformity at all. There's a test so that IBM is not conflicting if they change, if they change the labels later. Some people, for unknown reasons, had risk constraints on bashes. Not underscores, but bashes. They cannot be in other positions. More complex, more complete checks where names are like check themselves for proper creation, for availability, and so on. So, I don't know if the working group has anything to say about what they think, what people here think is a reasonable set of delegation checks, delegation checks, talking about things that happened before the domain is actually put into production. And in particular, what if this were applying not to your customers but to you, to the LDs? If you were going to put the TLD, a new TLD in action, what do you think is a reasonable set of tests that should be performed by the file zone on your too soon to be become live TLD? Do you think that the check should be full on? The domains, domain servers should be actually checked for availability. If you are using any guest servers, should they be checked from more than one position? I would like to hear more from the audience on that. The presentation is done. It's part of this question time. And the question is this time being asked by the presenter itself. So I'll just check.
And I think we can just open up the floor for like 5 minutes of discussion or so to be right back on schedule. I think we'll go first.
What's your GC admin? We have been running for quite a long time something called zone check. Maybe you're familiar with it.
Yes.
For communication checks under .fr. We used to have some complaints, and expectedly, there were the same people coming again and hoping to get off this zone check, and we are really bored of it. Very recently, with ETP deployment attack, actually, we just delayed the zone checking just after the registration with ETP. So I believe that all those complaints were, by the way, there are only a few of them. So we believe that the technical quality of, for whatever definition of technical quality of the CCTLD zone, we believe zone checking or checking medication, etc., is a very heavy thing. We believe we should continue to do it. And whether the tools is really complete, or is applicable with standards, is it including DNSSEC or not, is it including EDMS0 or TCP, and that is on its own with the words we can discuss in policy with the stakeholders, as we call them. And I mean, the principle in itself, I think it is a very good idea, and we are actually working on that, and we hope that it consistently other TLDs would take those set up. We are not in a position to teach people to do it, but we believe it is a good thing.
Okay. I see. So, one question. Would this same comparison with this tool be applied still if your time zone were to apply this checks to you? If the return we should?
Actually, I don't mind. We believe before even adding a name server for .fr or .re, we are very aware of that. It happens that we mistake it as everybody. I mean, but we believe that principle should be applied at every level. And independences of the, let's say, the autonomous systems, and we believe it should be applied uniformly. However, there are too many CCTLDs which
austerity, and that's one thing. That's local policy, I think. And as for the details of the checks, I think there are checks that you can say that should be performed every time that others are supposed to give a warning saying, hey, are you sure? Because we think this is a strength value, but we don't reject the registration because we think it's completely bogus. You might have proper reasons to do it. But that would be very interesting that if a test is performed, that the test is performed the same way at every DLT. So we don't get, complaints from customers saying, hey, but you do it a different way, and not FR does it, and not one. So I'm actually very interested in if you, for example, want to test it, something better, how do you actually do that the best way? The last thing I wanted to talk about is that pre-allocation checks are a good thing. It improves the quality, but doing checks on a continuous basis, also has some good things. And one of the things I'm thinking about is that I remember a couple of years ago, GPRX had some problems, the error rates had some problems, and there were phishing problems. People deleting game servers or zones where game servers were resident in. And these domains were registered by other sort of like criminal organizations just to be able to inject false information into the DNS and do phishing. We've thought about this, and the only thing that we can actually do to stop phishing is continue to see if name servers are still present in the DNS, and if not, do something to the domain names that are allocated to a warning customer saying, hey, do you know that your name server isn't working anymore? You might have an issue here if the domain name that was deleted and is to be registered again. Even if we can check that for our own zone, we can check that by looking at the registered database. But when a foreign name server is used, the only way we can check this is by delegation checks.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Johan, and myself, Joe, and user close.
This is Johan, and I'm not I'm well known skeptical of too much delegation checking because when I think this is clear within the authority of the channel and that. That said, I'm about to be in a position. So I agree that it's a point where I agree this is needed. It's clearly not enough to just do outreach and education. However, in the light of this being a necessary evil, if you like, I'm still much more in favor of delegation checks of stuff that's actually running, that is producing actual services that people depend on, than I am in favor of pre-delegation checks, because by definition, before the delegation has been made, no one is really depending on it. And therefore, I think it's reasonable to give the new delegation, the new child, the opportunity to actually courses are applied to the TOB itself or are applied to the TOB. Don't they just apply to these children? I'm going to ask you a second example here of the situation that I had with TELNIC and the TELTLD. So we'll just personalize those so this might help a little bit here. Whenever we change the delegation for GoTel, or if I have to get the delegation changed, the sort of things that I had always checking before was, will the response to the real response from the root servers fit in a single file for the entire reply? And do the main servers align up fair enough? However, in .tel, because it's all to do with NATO vectors and the DNS is the service, there's nothing else there other than DNS. The criteria that applies to the children, the delegated zones, are much, much stricter. And some of the tests that we would apply then were for things like you have to speak the DNS serial, because if you look at the large number of NATO vectors coming back, and it was also from the delegation point of view, the zones don't be delegated until they're properly set up. Things up and get successful answers without waiting for a broken data server to come back online. So the criteria can change depending on local policy, and local policies vary from TLD to TLD. And if you go back to the examples of CCTLDs, so I think some of this initial discussion started. We may have allocated factors that influence that too. For example, some countries with crazy ideas that all the data servers for that country must be inside that country. So how can you possibly reflect that in a generic delegation checking policy and mechanism? So I think we're going to have a generalized delegation checking model. All we can say is do the DHLD with the English records out for zone and have the data addresses for the actual new cells themselves. Anything beyond that, I think, can become quite problematical. Although there are some advisors against about what we think would be reasonable to apply and what might be the advantages and disadvantages of doing them.
Yeah, your distinction between the the DNS is the server itself, as opposed to the way to get that service.
These are called DNIC, not speaking as worker group share. DNIC has been doing pre-delegation checks from the very beginning, and we intend to continue to do so. We are doing this partly to protect our infrastructure, the quality of our services, and the services that we are providing to and with our members, and we have to support of the majority of registrars for this. For the unification of the tests, I think I just can follow up on what you said. Policy setting for CCTLDs is an open matter, and there's a variety in the customer base and local experiences and so on and so forth. So it might well make sense to have differences there. Nonetheless, of course, from a technical perspective, the checks should be reasonable, and I think ours are. Regarding your question, checks from the root zone. Policy-wise, there is a slight difference seen there. The root zone is, from our perspective, not seen as a registry of the same quality that the TLDs are.
Lower or higher?
Sorry?
Lower or higher?
guess this with all caveats applied, is it probably was probably approached from a purely policy setting perspective and acknowledging the fact that GTLD policy is developed in a completely different way than CCTLD policy. But I'm happy to follow up on that after I've done a bit more research and follow up with you properly.
Thank you. Joe, happy from ICANN. I was curious to just hear to answer your question before you answer it. Kevin Davies is not here. He's going to be here, but he's not. I don't work in the AI. So I don't have a good answer, but I wanted to ask if there's a message I can take back to him. Is there a general interest in having the IANA pre-delegation checks made public? If so, I can pass that on.
I don't personally answer it yet. It's always good to be to know what's the criteria you need to get to it.
The more basic observation is many people have made is the IANA does a whole bunch of technical checks, as well as the authorization checks that happen for any agent that returns, but it doesn't make any ongoing checks that result in communication back to the zone operators.
Yeah. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all for writing these here and preparing the slides. Okay, and next is Johan, I guess.
Same thing, but
is that there are technical issues with this, and those technical issues will certainly be studied. So the point of my presentation here is not to sort of jump the gun on that technical study, but instead I want to look in the middle space between technical issues and policy issues and problem space in general. So there will be more technical output later on when the study is concluded. So let's start by looking at demand. Demand is an interesting word. I think it's fair to say that there is a large demand for new TLDs. I think it's fair to say that anyone who's ever bought a domain name would be happy to buy the same domain name as a TLD. Price is, of course, an issue, but if we disregard price, we just look at what people would want to have. Demand is large. And because demand is really, really large, I mean, in the end, this is sort of the perfect product in the domain industry. This is a product that would just overshadow what all the TLDs are offering. Getting your own TLDs will always be sort of the trump card that is better. Expansion, regardless of your points, your position on whether expansion is good or bad, it will always be about holding back because you just cannot deal with all the pent-up demand that is down there. So, not losing control, holding back, make sure this doesn't get out of hand will always be needed. So, how large is the demand really? Well, that's impossible to judge. I think it's very clear that we can't have an infinite number of CFD relationships on the planet. I mean, over time, enterprises will just give up. They cannot register because IPs are not talking, and they cannot register IBM. And thousands and thousands and possibly millions of TLDs, sooner or later you will just give up. And it's making more difficult for IBM at your time, but that's a different story. So I think there's a natural boundary to how many TLD registries of the type we have today that the world can actually deal with. So that would probably sort itself out. But then we get into the enterprises, and there are lots of enterprises. And we also get into the IPR space. And when it comes to intellectual property, well, it gets even more complicated because those guys, they're not really asking for a domain name that they hope they get it before the other one. They are demanding that they get that particular domain name because they consider they have the right to it. That's an interesting problem space once you get into this collapse of the namespace that this actually means because everyone will sort of be competing in the same fraction of the namespace. So there are various problems there. And we also have sort of scary market drivers because once company A has their own TLD, I think it's quite obvious that company B will have more incentive not to be left behind. So we could see a lot of growth here, actually. And it's not the case that this will only be restricted to, well, normal TLDs. TLDs run the registries and say, what's the main names on the tree? It is specifically talked about the usefulness of TLDs for enterprises, and this is referred to as innovation in the namespace. I'm a bit skeptical, I admit. To me, these are just names. There's nothing you can do with a TLD that you can't do with another name further down with less risks to the rest of us. But of course, a shorter name is cooler from some respects. So, from a technical point of view, I'm still skeptical. But we have to look at this. So, what are the odds that actually be that bad? Well, the present small root. We have the really, really good property that most of the important conquests are actually cached in the recursive servers.
it's just a bunch of delegations. You cash the referrals to Cognac, New York, and agencies that deal with that are in your own country and neighboring countries, and you're basically set. And that would be a nice delivery credit service really all the time. So, is it worth it for people operating a full-time service, because that means we get less traffic or less, well, slightly less traffic at least. We still get all the traffic, but we get less of the real traffic. So I guess at the end of the day, we should be happy about that in some sort of roundabout way. But anything, it actually allows us to scale the system up further, because we do move traffic further down the train rather than have all the stuff go up the roof all the time. But it also has another kind of good property. For instance, we have the good property that should the route be unavailable for some sort of long period of time, it's actually not that much of a deal, because all the referrals that you usually need are already cashed. So for instance, when we had deals of accident against the route for your system, well, those typically are not detected by users, because the system still just works. They are detected by people watching monitoring systems or journalists looking for a story, rather than the technical community or the internet community in general really having an issue. But that's because there are just a few referrals and all of them are cached. If we basically flatten the namespace and we move millions of names up in the root zone, those will not be cached. And we immediately increase the dependency on the root all the time, and we lessen the robustness of the system, and suddenly attacks on the root service system will both be more dangerous for us as a community and more attractive to the attackers, because it will actually make a difference. That's not too good. And another important thing is that right now there are around 200 root server instances on the internet. That's the same order of magnitude as the number of countries on this planet. The root server operators are moving out in new places all the time. And although I cannot promise that we will have root servers in every country on the planet, it is sort of clear that we are slowly getting in that direction. And that's good, because if you have local root service and you have your local CCCLV service, then you're actually fine in spite of bad things happening on the internet, because the local name resolution will work even in remote corners. That's something to ponder. On the other hand, if we look at the really very large sounds like .com, a few others, .com being the largest one, of course. Well, incidentally, there are no .com servers in Africa. There may be for some time. I'm not saying Verisign is doing the wrong thing here. It's not a complaint about .com not being available everywhere. I'm just making an observation that .com is a very large zone. It's not easy to publish .com in every backyard. While we can easily publish the root zone in every backyard. And if .com fails to be available in every particular backyard, well, DNS still works. Root service is available. The national CCTLD is available, and a few other neighboring TLDs that are used. And if there is no local service for a particular zone like .com, well, for various reasons, local businesses tend to not use .com as much in those countries. I traveled in Africa. In Africa, .com is not nearly as popular as in, oh, let's go to more centralized parts of the internet. In Africa, the local TLD is more popular for a reason. But if we move all this stuff again, basically, I can just take an extreme feature. If we move all this stuff up in the root as some sort of
extrapolation. Then we basically getting sharing between the .com problem of distributing very massive amounts of data to far and remote corners, in spite of already having a system that actually works much better. So we're sort of moving in the wrong direction from a robustness perspective here, which is a bit worrying. Looking at this from a slightly different perspective, the reason we have the DNS today, the reason DNS looks the way it does today, is because it was designed to fulfill a specific set of design goals. This is a very old slide that I use when I do DNS training around the world, and I've done this since mid-90s, and this slide has basically stayed intact. It's been true from the start. So the reason DNS works the way it does is because we want to expand the namespace, and we want to localize our particular responsibility, and we want to minimize the net traffic and latency, and then we have the both reverse support with the protocol, and of course we want to have an accessible protocol. That's fine. So look at this. If we basically move stuff up into the root in a more aggressive way, we actually collapse the namespace to some extent. And we lose this property of localizing updates in lots of different places, which all goes to the massive database in the middle. And we lose optimizations in network traffic that are a function of caching that we will be depleting. And that doesn't look good. And to make it even worse, we actually have experience with the flat namespace. That's called the host.txt file. So if you again look at the extreme case here, the host.txt file had various problems. We designed DNS to deal with all these problems, and we got something that actually worked quite well. And time moves on, and now we're moving back in that direction again. I'm not saying that we are going all the way to host.txt, but there is a bit too much of a parallel here for comfort. It could be a sort of the host.txt file distributed over the DNS protocol, and that's sort of a scary thought. So that brings us to the really important topic here, and that is, how could we limit growth? I mean, I actually don't dispute that we could probably add a few hundred TLDs with no technical impact. I don't think there will be a problem with 10,000 new. But I'm scared about the end game, where this sort of just continues to roll. For that reason, I think it's important to have a mechanism in place to be able to say enough. And that, by the way, is one of the things that the technical study is aimed to look for. When is enough? What numbers are safe? And I want to go one step beyond that. I don't only want to know what is safe, I want to know how to stop it once we reach that point. And basically just two methods. One is financial barriers, and the other one is administrative barriers. So let's look at financial barriers. There is a formula of initial application fee. I don't really care what the amount of money is, but it's some amount. So the first argument I've heard when I raise my concerns about this getting out of hand and how to curb growth is, well, if needed, we will just raise the price. I see lots of problems with this. But let's ignore the part of money going right. That's a problem itself, but it's not my focus. The major problem here is that I have already stated that as volume goes up, the application fee will go down. So the application fee goes down, we will end up in a situation where
most of the early applications would probably be from, let's call it, the industrialized world. Not only, but a manufacturer. They have the spare cash for it, used to, at least. And then the application fee goes down and volume picks up, and the developing world jumps in because it's now reasonably priced. And then, suddenly the price goes up again because we need the current growth. I think there will be complaints about this. I think it's not possible to both aim for the lower price by increasing volume and at the same time aim for the higher price to curb growth. You just can't have it both ways. So I think this is not really thought out that it will work. Maybe just right. I don't know. But I would like to have something slightly more definite so that we know it will work. And I think it's not clear that this will work. So let's look at the admin barriers then. I think the admin barriers are really good. We have admin barriers today. I mean, when I send in an application for TLD, which I do now and then, they say, get out of here. That's a very good admin barrier, and it works. But the problem here with admin barriers is that if you want to design for growth, which is what ICANN wants, because they haven't made a decision that they want to grow, and you beef up your operation, and you hire new IANA staff, and you streamline your processes to be able to deal with a higher volume and accept more TLD for every time unit. Once you've done that, it would be much more difficult to say, sorry, for administrative reasons, we can only process 2 TLD applications per week. But that's a pure lie. Today it's probably true, but once you've hired 100 new staff and you have a streamlined operation, it will no longer be true. So I think this is a case of staying with the local policy is easier than to first open up the gates and then try to close them afterwards. So going back and trying to sort of summarize this, going back to the argument of demand and demand being large. If we look at the world as the TLD programmatic, the TLD programmatic really likes new TLDs. More TLDs. We want them now, we want them as cheaply as possible. The old plan was they're not getting any. That's sort of a tried method of dealing with drug addiction. And now we have a new plan, and it says, okay, we will hand out a fair number of these new TLDs, and hopefully you won't like them, and sort of demand will just peter out, and then we will just turn off the supply. I don't think that will work, actually, especially not when you see when you lower the price. So, I think there is a problem here.
Speaking of which, I'm sorry. We are running deep into the topic right now. We have a couple of remaining slides. Could you try to?
I will fast forward.
Okay, thank you.
And you will just have to have your reading exercise afterwards and just read through this if you like, or have a copy instead. The central theme, I think, is established, and abundance, scarce. There are problems with going from scarce to abundant and back to scarce again. We've covered that. There are problems with changing policies because when you sort of change the policy underneath people, that will cause them to adapt, then that causes its own set of problems. And once you define a certain number of variations that are safe, let's call that N, we would probably run into a different problem trying to deny the N plus 1 application, because there would be no technical ground for it. So even here, even if we define what is safe and what is not safe, we still have potential problems. I will skip this. And I will actually skip this too. And I will move to the last slide. So, what if Western, I don't know about education in other countries, but I know that in Sweden, but the what if education, sorry, the what if question is actually
to ask the what if question. What if this happens? I mean, that's the way you design an aircraft, not because you think it will fail, but what if, etc. So, what if questions are really important when you want to do prudent design from a safety perspective. So, what if? There really is no practical way of limiting growth once it is started. I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying no one has proved that it's not true. There is a risk here, and it should be studied. But if it turns out that this is an unfounded growth, doesn't work too well. What if we don't have a plan B? Because once you've sold the TLD, it will be sort of difficult to take it back. And what if, just to make this really, really, really concrete, we have to choose between signing the route, because for a small sum, it is technically easy to sign, or do a really, really massive expansion of the stone, which might preclude signing. Again, I'm not saying this is a fact. I'm saying it's something that should be considered. Because one of the problems with having the non-technical people make decisions like this is that they usually take the candy door, the candy store approach. They are kids, they get into the candy store and they want the yellow stuff and they want the blue stuff and they want the red stuff. But from an engineering point of view, sometimes you have to explain to them that you can get this or that, not both. Okay, I'm done. Sorry for the thing.
Thanks very much, Johan. I don't think we have very much time for discussion. We will come to a plenary anyway. And we have two announcements afterwards, so the both of you end up.
Just add that
action item today on Anand and the chairs to take care of the land delegation reports. The other one from yesterday on the domain objects, NRS 57.1, with the postponed discussion about today, DLV registration of the NCC's NCC maintained keys. My suggestion is that the working group gives the working group chairs the responsibility to coordinate with Anand again to take care of this. Is that okay with you? No opposition, great. Okay, so that's basically it. I would like to thank everybody, all the presenters, our many papers and online tribe, and the technical support from the Lab NCC. Thank you for your patience. And the last thing between you and your t-shirt is me thanking you, and bye-bye. See you in, I guess, Lisbon.